You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello everyone, welcome to Justice Lit. We are back again with another episode of the Shakespeare series. We left off at Sonnet 131, and so we'll start with 132 today and kind of go on forward then. But today I want to try something a little different instead of just kind of getting right into the sonnets after a couple songs or just one. I want to play for you guys several songs first, and then we'll kind of conclude up until the end with the sonnets. And so I think the first half, or just less than the first half of the show, would be songs, and then we'll start on with the sonnets after those. I have five songs to play for you people. And so, yeah, just after the ads, show promos, and PSAs, I'll introduce you to the first song. So we'll be right back.
On Home and Haunting deals with the uncertainty of memory as a mode by which artists conceive and construct their films. Using the language of hauntology, which deals with the ways social, cultural, and political issues from the past haunt the present, and how it connects us to the unresolved state of capitalist violence across time and embedded into history, this program highlights three artists working within this realm of the indelible: Han Pham, Adam Garnett Jones, and Luis Andres Serrano. The works of these artists are ghostly. They inhabit places of the past only possible from the present. And film is a medium favorable for these hauntings. From August 11th to September 3rd, 2025, the Belkin's outdoor screen will show On Home and Haunting daily between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m., a selection of films curated by Ogeneo Fegor Obuoma. You can also join Obuoma and filmmakers Han Pham and Luis Andres Serrano at the Belkin Gallery on Thursday, August 14th at 6 p.m. for a conversation about their work. To find out more, visit belkin.ubc.ca. That's belkin.ubc.ca.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's R-I-D-E-O-N Bike Shop. See you there!
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the News Collective, the Arts Collective, The Music Collective, the Sports Collective, the Accessibility Collective, the Indigenous Collective, and the Intersectionality Collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
What do you love, and what do you love about it? My name is Ewan, and with I Love You Hour, I want to know. Come join me bi-weekly Tuesdays at 6 p.m. to discuss music and the stories we connect to it, either in person, on the phone, or through messages at I Love You Hour on Instagram. That's I-L-U-V-U Hour on Instagram, or through email at iluvhour@gmail.com. If you love sharing music and telling stories, listen to I Love You Hour bi-weekly at CITR 101.9. And remember, I love you.
Welcome back. Those were some ads, show promos, and PSAs. We'll get right into the first song. It's called Son of the Sun by Willie Dunn. So we'll be right back after this.
Son of the sun, son of the earth, the soul of life, children of the world, daughters of starlight, and daughters of mirth, sisters of sunlight, sisters of earth, brothers of nature, brothers of old, brothers of legend. And the story untold. I had a dream a mile across. They laid to rest with a gun and a sword. Buried the hatchet, buried the snake, bowed to each other. The earth supplies and nature feeds, but we turn and quake for artificial needs. Come down to earth and stay a while. The sun is shining, just sit there and smile. I'm a brown-skinned man, that's what I am. Got a guitar and a drum, that's where I come from. Spirit of the sun, spirit of the sea, worthy of a shadow, come shine down on me. Nature, brothers of old, brothers of legend, and the story untold. Daughters of starlight, daughters of earth, sisters of sunlight, sisters of birth. I had a dream a mile ago.
they drew rest with gun and a sword. Bury the hatchet, they bury the snake. Bow to each other, peace to make. Oh, son of the sun.
That was Son of the Sun by Willie Dunn. Our next song is called Yellowhead Song, also from Willie Dunn. Here we go.
I used to roam the plains on a wild windy day, out amidst the grasslands and the sage. The wind rages over the land, a place in every hand. The wilds between the ponies and the stage. And contradictions flew between past and future due. And the order of the day was towards indifferent. The wind howled out his song, like old winter's long, while the stars, like distant warriors, sang his song. I'd like to go where the buffalo roam, where the coyotes howl and the west wind moan, where the sky is wide like an endless ride, with the blizzard's rage over rolling sage, over rolling sage.
That was Yellowhead Song by Willie Dunn. Our next song is called Take Your Time by George Leach. We'll be right back after this.
Mm-hmm.
That was George Leach's Take Your Time. Our next song is called Wounded Lake by Willie Dunn. Here we go.
No politics alive to round the smoky sky would lay here and there beneath the sun. And the driftwood by my shores, bleach whiteness though their pores, be riddled through and through by the worms. And I've been here a long, long while, seen your granddad as a child, and I know his son's a lot like himself. The ducks, the geese, and loons have striven many, many moons all along the sands and reeds of my shore. Apologies to none who would come here with a gun and hunt the bears and birds upon the hills, or to fish these waters till they may have had their fill and go home happily in their grace. But I would remind you now, if you enjoy this anyhow, that is the fish and game along the shore. Go back to the factory, filter that reactory, and you'll be welcome as you were before. And I've been here a long, long while, seen you as a child, and I know your son's a lot like yourself. The ducks, the geese, and the loons have striven many, many moons along the sands and reeds of my shore. I've been here a long, long while, seeing you boy as a child, and I know your son's a lot like yourself. The ducks, the geese, and the loons have striven many, many moons all along the sands and reeds of my shore. No politics survive. Sky, but lay here limpid beneath the sun, and the driftwood by my shores, bleach whiteness though their pores, be riddled through and through by the worms. The ducks, the geese, and loons have striven many, many moons all along the sand and reeds of my shore. Sands and reeds of my shore.
That was Wounded Lake by Willie Dunn, and our last song of the day is called Covenant Chain, also by Willie Dunn.
Once upon a covenant chain, you were inconsiderate and weak. Well, we were strong and numerous, and allowed your voice to speak. Peace and trade and friendship around the campfire's wake. And we fastened your ship to that covenant chain, apprehensive that the bark might break. Brother, we can recall a day when one could say you were me. Those were the days of friendship, we all lived side by side. You and your old gunboat, we with our canoe-like pride. those were the days of friendship. We struck it in the rain, when toil was the upshot and the downshot was the pain. We, your oldest allies, goes back a long, long time, when at first you landed here from out with salty brine. Who were the ones who described the land where the bride of one showing his shrine, where the cliffs were the walls of his castle, the sky the height of his pride, down the space of the prairie where the whitened buffalo was God. Those were the days when the rage of war and the plague decreased our size, when the French and Dutch with the musket balls could nip us on the rise. And later revolution came, and we teetered twixt the two, the people torn, some stayed, some shorn, but we on to Canada flew. Brother, the road of red man white long grown up with trees. Now you are strong and numerous, and we ask that we might speak. Peace, trade, and friendship around the campfire's way. Then we fasten your ship to the covenant chain, apprehensive that the bark might break.
That was The Covenant Chain by Willie Dunn. Those were five songs for you guys. We'll now get into the sonnets. We left off at Sonnet 131, and so Sonnet 132 will start off. Thine eyes I love, and they as pitying me, knowing thy heart torment me with disdain, have put on black and loving mourners be, looking with pretty ruth upon my pain. And truly not the morning sun of heaven better becomes the grey cheeks of the east, nor that full star that ushers in the even doth half that glory to the sober west, as those two morning eyes become thy face. Oh, let it then as well beseem thy heart to mourn for me, since morning doth thee grace and suit thy pity like in every part. Then I swear beauty herself is black, and all they foul that thy complexion lack. Now here the poet begs the mistress to model her heart after her eyes, which, because they are black, as if dressed in mourning, show her pity for his pain as a lover. And so, to go into lines 1-4, the speaker begins with a paradox. Now, though the beloved's heart is full of disdain, the eyes seem to pity him. He projects emotion onto the eyes in one of the phrases. So, for example, they put on black like mourning clothes, and that aligns with the traditional signs of grief. The word ruth suggests that even if the beloved does not love him, her eyes do, or at least perform, a kind of soft sorrow. This therefore sets up a split between outward appearance and inner feeling, and between perceived cruelty and imagined sympathy. The speaker interprets black eyes not as dull or unbeautiful, but as deeply expressive. And there's also a sense of an erotic masochism here too, as he reads her coldness as something to cherish, if only her eyes look kindly on his pain. With lines 5-8, now these lines shift to a bit of a celestial comparison. The morning sun illuminating the gray cheeks of the east, and the evening star which is in this sense Venus, adorning the sober West becomes metaphors for beauty revealed in contrast or mourning. The gray and sober skies evoke melancholy, twilight, and ambiguity. And the atmospheres that match the beloved's black eyes. Moving on to lines 9 to 12. Now here the speaker makes a plea. If your eyes mourn so beautifully, let your heart do the same. So the line, mourning doth thee grace, is key here as it flips the usual association of mourning with sorrow or ugliness into something aesthetic, into something elegant and even desirable. Mourning here becomes a kind of erotic costume that suits the beloved's appearance and perhaps should also shape her emotional comportment. And so there's a bit of a flattery and subtle manipulation in this request. So in the phrase, since you look so lovely in grief, why not grieve for me? Now, oh, let it as well beseem to mourn for me, since mourn doth thee grace. Sober West becomes thy face. Yeah, so there's a bit of a request here. And so this kind of explains how he aestheticizes his own pain and makes it part of the beloved's beauty. The final couplet is a delivering of a bold rhetorical reversal. And so, in this sense, the assertion here is that true beauty is black, which kind of counters the dominant Elizabethan ideal that privileged fair skin, light eyes, and golden blonde hair. And so this declaration is both erotic and political in its subversion of racialized and gendered standards of beauty. And we can see that the speaker elevates blackness not just as an acceptable form of beauty, but as beauty herself. And so that was Sonnet 132. Moving on to Sonnet 133. Beshrew that heart that makes my heart to groan, for that deep wound it gives my friend and me. Is it not enough to torture me alone, but slave to slavery my sweetest friend must be? Me from myself thy cruel eye hath taken, and my next self thou harder hast engrossed. Of him myself in thee I am forsaken, a torment thrice threefold thus to be crossed. Prison my heart in thy steel bosom's ward, but then my friend's heart let my poor heart bail. Whoever keeps me, let my heart be his guard. Thou canst not then use rigor in my jail, and yet thou wilt, for I, being pent in thee, perforce am thine and all that is in me. Now, the pain felt by the poet as lover of the mistress is multiplied by the fact that the beloved friend is also enslaved by her. And so in lines 1 and 2, we are opened with a curse. And so the phrase beshrew, meaning roughly damn or curse. And it's the curse that is directed at the beloved's heart. The speaker accuses it of causing pain not only to himself, but also to his friend. The word groan evokes physical suffering and emotional grief. The phrase deep wound immediately introduces a metaphor of love as injury, suggesting betrayal, emotional trauma, or erotic entanglement that has gone wrong. And so that the wound affects both the speaker and his friend, introduces a triangle of affliction, and sets up the central tension of divided affection and shared torment. With lines 3 and 4, The speaker's suffering is not enough for the beloved, who also must enslave the speaker's friend. The language of slavery is intense and repeated in the phrase slave to slavery, and how that doubles subjugation. This not only reinforces the idea of emotional captivity, but also evokes erotic and power-laden connotations. There's bitterness in the question, the rhetorical question, where the beloved's cruelty exceeds private torment and now spills into the speaker's closest bond. Now, lines 5 and 6, here the identity begins to unravel. The beloved's cruel eye, which might suggest both the gaze and the judgment, has taken the speaker from himself, a kind of psychic alienation or dissociation. His next self kind of has been engrossed, and it's been engrossed harder, implying the friend has been more completely consumed. The beloved now possesses both the speaker's internal sense of self and his external relational double. And so we can see that there is a triple entanglement of subjectivity. With lines 7 and 8, the speaker is now forsaken or abandoned by all three. His friend, himself, and the beloved. It's a stunning collapse in the sense of a relational structure. The phrase thrice threefold exaggerates the torment, as it isn't just triple, but a torment magnified, suggesting a recursive suffering that loops endlessly through these relationships. The word crossed connotes both suffering and betrayal. It's seen in the phrase cross to bear, and while also suggesting thwarted desires or ill-fated love. With lines 9 to 10, the beloved's steel bosom is a striking image of emotional coldness or inaccessibility. To prison the speaker's heart in this fortified chest turns the erotic metaphor into literal incarceration. However, even in this imprisonment, he begs for some mercy. And so he begs that his heart be bailed out from his friends. And the legal language of bail implies exchange, debt, and release, but also suggests that love itself is transactional, which is governed by laws and punishment. With lines 11 to 12, the speaker imagines his heart serving as guard to whoever keeps him prisoner, paradoxically suggesting that even in captivity, his heart remains active, loyal, and perhaps protective. Now, if his heart guards his jailer, then the beloved cannot be too harsh. And so this creates an odd inversion, where the prisoner may regulate the cruelty of their own imprisonment, and there is also hope, however fragile, of mitigating the beloved's severity through mutual effect. The final couplet kind of admits defeat, as despite the logic, despite the pleas, the speaker knows the beloved will still be cruel. And the phrase pent in thee evokes not only emotional captivity, but also sexual confinement or enclosure. And so the final assertion, the phrase, perforce I'm thine and all that is in me, that kind of suggests total inescapable possession. And so the beloved owns the speaker completely, the body, mind, soul, and relational bonds. And this total subjugation is not romanticized, but is seen as an agonizing final plea, or final situation. Moving on to Sonnet 134. So now I have confessed that he is thine, and I myself am mortgaged to thy will. Myself I'll forfeit, so that other mine thou wilt restore to be my comfort still. But thou wilt not, nor he will not be free, for thou art covetous, and he is kind. He learned but surety like to write for me, under that bond that him as fast doth blind. The statute of thy beauty thou wilt take, thou usurer that puttest forth all to use, and sue a friend came debtor for my sake, for him I lose through my unkind abuse. Him have I lost, thou hast both him and me, he pays the whole, and yet am I not free. And so, kind of going on from the previous poem, the poet continues to rationalize the young man's betrayal, here using language of debt and forfeit. And so, lines 1 and 4, the phrase, "So now I have confessed that he is thine," the speaker kind of admits that the fair youth, once perhaps is alone, now belongs to the mistress. The phrase, "Myself I'll forfeit," the speaker is willing to give himself up entirely and to lose his own freedom. Lines 5 and 8, "But thou wilt not, nor he will not be free." Now here neither the mistress nor the friend will release the speaker or each other. Everyone is bound in this triangle. The phrase, "He learned but surety like to write for me." So surety is a legal term for someone who accuses responsibility for another's debt. The friend signed a bond, a contract, thinking he was helping the speaker. With lines 9 to 12, "The statute of thy beauty thou wilt take." And so this phrase, the mistress enforces the statute of her beauty, and claims that the right to use it as power over others. The phrase, "And sue a friend came debtor for my sake," the friend who became a debtor, perhaps by loving her on the speaker's behalf, is now being sued by her. The final couplet, "Him have I lost," plain and heartbreaking admission, "and he pays the whole." That phrase is seen as the friend bearing the full cost of his bond, perhaps in guilt, in love, or in being caught. And the final phrase, "And yet I am not free," kind of despite the friend's sacrifice, the speaker remains bound, emotionally enslaved, and still suffering. Sonnet 135. "Whoever hath her wish, thou hast thy will, and will to boot, and will an overplus. More than enough am I that vex thee still, to thy sweet will making addition less. Wilt thou, whose will is large and spacious, not once vouchsafe to hide my will in thine? Shall will in others seem right gracious, and in my will no fair acceptance shine? The sea all water yet receives rain still, and in abundance a death to his store. So thou, being rich in will, add to thy will one will of mine to make thy large will more. Let no unkind, no fair beseechers kill. Think all but one, and me in that one will." And so here the poet apparently begs his promiscuous mistress to allow him back into her bed. With lines 1 and 2, the speaker opens by playing on the name and concept of will, a pun that occurs repeatedly throughout the sonnet. And so here, will can mean multiple things, but it could mean desire or volition. Will can mean sexual desire. Will can mean genitalia, both male and female, in kind of the Elizabethan slang. And will can also mean the speaker's own name. So as in William Shakespeare. The opening couplet implies that while others may get what they wish, the beloved has not only her own will, in the sense desire or agency, but an overabundance of will, both in quantity and intensity. So this already sets up a tension between lack, the speaker, and excess, the beloved. The phrasing, "and will to boot, and will an overplus," suggests that the beloved's capacity for desire or sexual engagement is large, perhaps indiscriminately so. With lines 3-4, the speaker acknowledges himself as one more than enough kind of surplus suitor who continues to vex or trouble the beloved. There's a paradox here, though. He is too much, and yet he seeks to add himself to her already overflowing sweet will. And so the speaker desires incorporation into her will, despite being a burden. And so this implies a painful awareness of rejection, but also persistence as the speaker continues to press his case even while recognizing his undesirability. With lines 5-6, here the speaker flatters the beloved by referring to her as large and spacious. And on the surface, this could suggest emotional or erotic generosity, but it also carries a sexual connotation of bodily openness. The request to hide my will in thine functions both as a plea for union of emotional or sexual cases, and as a metaphysical fantasy of subsuming selfhood, a loss of autonomy within the other's being. This might evoke a kind of erotic mysticism, where the boundary between selves is, in a sense, blurred or kind of covered. With lines 7-8, these lines suggest a kind of jealousy or wounded pride. The beloved accepts others' wills graciously, but the speaker's own will is rejected or not seen as fair. And so the sonnet thus stages a competition between desires where the beloved's promiscuity or openness to others intensifies the speaker's sense of exclusion. The speaker feels unjustly spurned despite offering the same thing, which here is his will. With lines 9-10, here this couplet kind of introduces a natural metaphor. And so the sea, already full of water, still receives and accepts more. The image suggests boundless capacity and implies that even fullness does not preclude further reception. The speaker thus extends the logic of plenitude to the beloved. Her being full of will should not exclude one more. And the sea also introduces a kind of erotic sublimity, which is seen as vast, open, and receptive. Moving on to lines 11-12. Now, this could be seen as the crux of the argument. So if the sea can receive more water, why can't the beloved, rich in will, receive one more will? So namely, the will of the speakers. And so this is both a rhetorical and erotic plea, and the wordplay sustains its triple force of the beloved being rich in desire, being rich in sexual partners, and being rich in self-will or autonomy. And so yet even so, the speaker argues that there is room for him. And so this line could also suggest a desire not just for erotic union, but for recognition, a wish for his will to be acknowledged and integrated. Moving on to the final couplet, the sonnet closes with a final emotional appeal. And so let no unkind, no fair beseechers kill is syntactically ambiguous, but seems to mean don't be cruel, don't kill your fair suitors with rejection. But also perhaps don't kill desire itself as well. And the final line, think all but one and me in that one will, compresses kind of the metaphorical or metaphysical wish, where the beloved may have many suitors, but the speaker wants to be the singular one, or wants to be a part of the universal one will, a merging of selves. And the poem also ends on a paradox, where he wants to be singular and part of the beloved's capacious, excessive desire. And so that was Sonnet 135, and we have come to the end of the episode already, and so we will end the sonnets here. But overall, a good kind of analysis of the poems. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week. I will see you guys again next episode. And yeah, have yourselves a great day. Also, we did get rain for the first time in weeks today, which kind of felt nice, but the sun is starting to kind of creep up, and so that's good. But yeah, have yourself a good week, and I will see you again next episode. Thank you all. Bye-bye. Keep and she gives me that box to fill.